Coming up this week in computer hardware, Intel says 2020 for discrete GPUs, Optane acceleration for secondary storage. It ain't a bad idea. AMD FreeSync for HDR and TVs. Apple locks down the Lightning port, and Killer Networks has a killer idea. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 470, recorded June 14, 2018. And then there were three.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. Stop crime before it happens and help make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Go to ring.com/Twitch and get up to $150 off of a Ring of Security kit.
Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most delightful, most engaging, most affordable, occasionally most expensive, and today possibly most ridiculous hardware news available anywhere, anyhow, anytime, in any known or unknown universe. I read that in the contract recently, and any currently known or unknown universe is my new favorite thing to find in a terms of service on a contract. Ryan, are you currently in the known universe or an unknown universe?
Well, there are no windows that see outside, so it's really hard for me to tell. Somebody could have moved the building. I don't think they did.
Well,
known,
assuming
is my guess.
Dr. Strange hasn't wandered into Florence, Kentucky, the home of PC Perspective, PCPer.com, and shifted Ryan's reality. Mm-hmm. Speaking of shifting reality, a lot of odd stories this week. A lot of follow-ups up to Computex. One of the big announcements, Intel going to compete with NVIDIA and AMD, because I think Intel's been executing so flawlessly on so many fronts, they needed to open up another front with two of the most competitive companies in technology. Did I say that out loud? I'm so sorry. You wrote up for MarketWatch that Brian Kazanich confirmed that they're going to ship their first discrete graphics chip in 2020. I'm going to flat out ask, do you believe that's even remotely possible? They brought in some pretty serious talent from AMD. But, you know, I think the word you used was aggressive, and I think you were being euphemistic in your choice of that word.
A little bit, perhaps. So if we base this on, I think, a three-year cycle of ground up GPU design, you know, from hey, we should do a GPU to hey, there's a GPU for sale. 3 years is pretty good. And I would say 3 to 4 years is probably on average. You get a little bit of a head start because of the people you bring in at Intel. And you probably, chances are there were already people at Intel working down this direction. And then the people that would come in would say, hey, let's change this, let's modify this, let's you know, drastically change. They could have said, actually, this is all crap, start over from zero. Or they could have said, okay, this is a good base. You've saved us 6 months of work. Let's go from here. So I think 3 years is still reasonable. And if you look at, Raja came over in what, November of 2017. So November of 2020 still counts as 2020. And that would be your 3 year out from his specific arrival. So I'd still say, yes, it's aggressive, but I think it's feasible, and it's also, I think Intel needs to be aggressive in this mm-hmm. spot, right? They are well behind everybody, and by well behind, I mean they don't have an option at all. So they're very far behind. People who, I don't want anybody tweeting at me. Yes, Intel used to make discrete video cards back in the day of like 2002, mm-hmm. 1998, that type of stuff, but not in this type of thing. And the other thing that BK said at this analyst meeting was that 2020 was going to happen. That was their target. And that they were both going to build for consumer and enterprise spaces. And that was kind of always assumed, but it was never really specifically stated. That consumer, right, which would cover gaming, it would cover, notebooks, it would cover professional visualization like the Quadro competition. And then your enterprise, your machine learning, your AI, all those emerging workloads there. So that was also new. I think it makes sense. I think probably why would they tell us now? There were some people who were commenting, why would you pre-announce something like this that far in advance? And I think a lot of that comes from there had been a lot of rumors a month or two ago that, oh, Intel's going to have, they're going to launch their GPU product at CES 2019, which is, you know, in less than 6 months. And that was, it was never a feasible option. It was always kind of crazy to talk like that, but the rumor mill had started to churn up and was mm-hmm. solidifying into this avenue. And so I think for them, it was as much of a, we need to control this story now. It's going to blow up. And what they didn't want it to be was right. Intel delays GPU release, Intel delays GPU release, et cetera. When in reality, they're always planning on this particular timetable. So now it's out there. Now we know, now there's no question about it. And now, well, now there's no question about timing, but now there's a ton of questions about which one are they going to do first? They're going to do like a mid-range part? Are they going to do a high-end right. part? Are they going to target, you know, gamers or enterprise? It probably makes sense to start with AI, machine learning, because that's where your biggest threat is from NVIDIA, right? Like Intel's not threatened by GeForce and Radeon because they're not in that space. They are threatened by Tesla, machine learning, AI, because that's going into their enterprise space. So that's one reason to go there. There's much higher margins there, right? So if you have difficulty making these first rounds of chips, then mm-hmm. it's okay. You can make up for it because of that higher margin that you get to charge. Whereas with the gaming is where you go where when you know your architecture, you know how things are yielding and you have your software set up exactly right. That's where the you know, hey, if you're 4 or 5% behind, you know, a GeForce part or Radeon part, you're going to get smacked around for it pretty dramatically. That's where that story is. So they need to make sure they have everything else in line before they get there. But, I mean, 2020 is not that far, right? Technically only 18 months away. But that gives them up to, what is that? Plus six more. So 24 months total to kind of get there, a little bit beyond that. So it'll be interesting.
It will be, especially in the commentary on Intel at Computex has been kind of brutal. We'll get in a little bit more into that a little bit later in the podcast, but I'm kind of excited to see. I have not watched the complete thing yet, but AMD sat down with you guys at PC Purge to talk about FreeSync for HDR and televisions, which is pretty awesome if you've been dealing with tearing and gaming on your big screen and so, you know, already enabled on some Samsung TVs. Have you guys had a chance to test this yet? And, you know, what did AMD tell you about their long-term plans for FreeSync and HDR and the living room?
So we haven't actually had the stream yet. It's this coming Tuesday.
Oh.
Where AMD will be here to talk about their FreeSync changes in TV, but that doesn't. I mean, I still think it's a good topic of discussion to have in regards to what FreeSync TV is and what it could be and what it means. I still don't have one of those TVs. Actually, we're supposed to get one in before they show up on Tuesday, so hopefully it will get here tomorrow. Otherwise, we won't have very much time to be setting it up. But you know, in the G-Sync versus FreeSync battle. Through the years, FreeSync has always been has always had the quantity argument. You know, right. We have, you know, three times as many FreeSync enabled monitors as NVIDIA has G-Sync enabled monitors, and that argument is fine, but it's not always what people are looking for. I, as the consumer of one monitor on a gaming system, right? I don't really care how many different monitors are out there. I care about how many good ones there are and what right. they cost and how good they are. How do they compare to the competition, right? So in reality, if there was one monitor that was $300 that was 4K HDR FreeSync, then I don't care if there's ever another one, right? Until the next right. technology comes around. But what they can now start to do, AMD, I mean, what they can now start to target and pitch is like, okay, but we're not just PC gaming. Now, you know, FreeSync is enabled on Xbox. Now, TVs are supporting this, and you can hook your Xbox up to that TV, or you can hook up your gaming PC to that mm-hmm. TV. And people who have seen and understood the variable refresh benefits, and it's one of those things that is kind of hard to explain
right.
the advantages of without seeing it in person, much like 3D, much like HDR. So you see it and you believe it, and then you know, when G-Sync and FreeSync were first out, it was like, yes, I want this on everything. I want this on my TV so that 24 frames per second movies play back correctly. Or, you know, my game console that is currently locked at 30 frames per second on some games has the ability to go to 40 or 50 frames
right.
and still be smooth, because they don't do that because they can't reach 60. And so this kind of sets the stage for AMD to be the ecosystem changer. NVIDIA arguably has the better technology still. That's what they'll tell you. And that's what people who are using that technology would tell you. But there's a legitimate argument to have about that. And then if the ecosystem wins out, it may not matter, right? You can go back all the way back to, what is it, VHS and beta, and say, I think people, I wasn't a part of my discussion at the time. I wasn't in that technology field, but the argument has always been the Betamax was always better, but the VHS ecosystem blew up and it didn't matter anymore. Right. And so that's kind of where you could analog that out a little bit if you wanted to.
It's interesting to look at, ratings.com, RTINGS.com is one of the better sites for looking at television evaluations right now. They do some really extensive testing, and it's interesting to watch them because they've just added variable refresh rate testing in their lineup. And it's interesting because one, because they've got a link there where they list all the televisions they've tested, and literally 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of like 59 in the current round of testing support variable refresh rate. It's all FreeSync. They're all Samsungs. They're 4K variable refresh maximum frame rate is 60 hertz. The minimum is 48 hertz. They can do 120 hertz in 1080p mode. It's all over HDMI. I'm kind of curious to see how this evolved, because it was not until late May, like the end of May, that the firmware was released for the Samsung TVs that brought out FreeSync support. And they managed to find out that FreeSync was supported on their Xbox One S and the Radeon RX 580 GPU and 1080p, 1440p, and 4K resolutions. You got to turn on the TV's game mode and the FreeSync settings. You don't have to go into PC mode. They said test in ultimate or run it in ultimate mode unless you have troubles, then you can go back to basic mode. But they seem pretty pleased with it so far. And having played around with gaming on 30 hertz 4K monitors in the very early days of 4K televisions, I got to say I'm down with 60 hertz. And given how massive that screen is and how many pixels you're rolling, I can only see gaming benefiting from a higher refresh rate and variable refresh rate. I was testing BenQ's ultra wide screen monitor with FreeSync support, and one, it was amazing how much I enjoyed getting like 100 hertz off my 1070 on that card. And two, it was amazing how bad the tearing was without having the variable refresh rate support turned on. It was just like, because it just takes a long time for that tear to work its way across that giant screen.
If you get in one of those specific frame rates where, yes, you can see the tear follow. It's like almost like old school TV scan lines, right? Where you just see it trickle up. If it's just at the right frame rate for it. Yeah. So yeah, the event that we're hosting, where AMD's coming out here, they're going to talk about the FreeSync on consoles, HDR implementations, TV implementations. That's this coming Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern at PCPro.com if you guys want to check it out. And we are, if you have questions, if you have thoughts or ideas or complaints or whatever you want, if you leave them in the comments section of PCPro.com, a significant portion of this event is answering those readers' questions. So let us know what you want to know.
Ken got heads on using Intel Optane memory to accelerate secondary storage. Usually think of that as being like, we're going to accelerate the incredibly slow drive your operating system is on. How difficult was that for Core i7 8700, Gigabyte H370, Aorus gaming motherboard, 16 gigabytes of RAM, and then an Intel SSD Optane 800P, and then the Optane memory, 64 gigabyte, and a 1 terabyte Western Digital Black. It looked like it was, on the surface, it looks like it should have been fairly easy to set up. Am I grossly misreading his write-up on that, or did it actually kind of work the way it was supposed to the first time?
Nope. Setup was simple and straightforward. Go ahead.
Oh, no. All you.
Yeah, I mean, the setup is simple. The Intel Optane memory caching software is dead easy. You install the drive, you install the piece of software, it recognizes it, you hit a button, yes, I want to. There's no configuration. There's the fallback is there's no configuration, so there's no flexibility, but it is, you've right. got a 32 gig, you've got a 64 gig Optane in there, do you want to enable caching? Yes. It does a thing, it reboots, caching's working, right? You never really have to think about it again. And what's new now is they've updated the software to allow you to cache the non-OS drive, which is really interesting, right? And that's kind of, you know, it's a little bit odd that this was never a part of it to begin with. But now if you, and I think this actually makes more sense for enthusiasts, right? Enthusiasts, you're probably not going to be on a spinning hard drive for your primary drive. You've got an SSD of some kind. It might be 250 gigs or 512 gigs or what have you. But because of that, you know, it's not necessary for you to enable Optane caching on that. Will it speed things up a little bit? Yes, a little bit, but not dramatically. So the alternative now is, okay, well, it turns out I've got a 250 gig SSD, but I've got this 2 terabyte hard drive with a bunch of Steam games on it or my photo library or what have you. And you can use this 30 gig, $35, 32 gig Optane cache, or in our case, they sent us a 64 gig, enable it, boom, done. And now it's, hey, whatever the game you're playing most frequently on that hard drive is now accelerated, and you don't have to worry about moving things from your SSD to your hard drive or back and forth, depending on what your gaming patterns happen to be that week or that month. And it worked pretty well, actually. He tested, you know, Ashes of the Singularity load times went from 46 seconds down to 19 seconds when running the Optane cache, you know, after the second load as well. It takes one time to kind of load it into the Optane cache, as always, any kind of caching system, and then it's accelerated from there. You can look at like Lightroom photo import went from, I think it was 500 raw files from an A7S2 took it from 40 seconds to 23 seconds, right? So some pretty significant performance deltas there. PC Mark 10 saw advantages in the subtest. App startup makes sense. You see some benefits there. Essentials, which is kind of like your productivity stuff. Again, a lot of that is app opening and closing timeframes. All that worked. There's a little bit of a comparison in there to AMD's Store MI that also does very well in its own right using the Optane technology. But the 8700K plus Optane caching worked really well. And it's a cheap enough addition. Like I said, I want to double check that now because I don't want to misspeak. The 32 gig Optane is $50. So for a $50 add-on, you can get that. You can get the 16 gig for less as well. So it's a little bit more than I think I said 30 before. But for $50, you can now not have to worry about your slow hard drive speeds. And the system that Intel sent for the testing was fairly realistic. You know, you've got an SSD as your main drive, then you use Optane plus hard drive. I think they're using like a 1 terabyte black or something like that, a very common, very popular drive. So I think it's neat. More of this stuff is coming out. The Optane memory story is widening. I think Gigabyte announced they had some motherboards that were shipping with Optane pre-installed. And then you would be able to configure that either for your primary boot drive or for your secondary drives, however you wanted it to go. One interesting thing worth noting that's not really part of the story that I've seen is now something that I don't really like is now both Dell and HP are selling laptops that are being marketed as having 24 gigs of memory. But in actuality, it is 8 gigs of DDR4 and 16 gigs of Optane. And I understand the intent behind the messaging. It is ill-advised, I would say, and you know, kind of a little bit deceitful to what you're getting. Because yes, Optane, basically, if you run out of system memory, Optane will accelerate whatever things you may be loading in after that. But you still aren't going to be able to have more applications open at the same time than if you just had 8 gigs of memory and no Optane. It's just, will they be able to swap back and forth a little bit faster? So, you know, Intel's trying hard to push Optane. I think it's really good in some instances. You know, the 900P really liked, the 905P we really liked, 800P was pretty good. And the Optane memory is interesting and different and totally different kind of segment, but definitely getting the job done. So, you know, don't confuse people with unnecessary complications, which I think is where we're at with that particular issue. But overall, still good.
In a not entirely random and unrelated note, I want to point out right now, Samsung's 850 EVO 1 terabyte drives are selling for $248 on Amazon. And one of Alan's favorite bargains, the Crucial MX500 1 terabyte, selling for $230. Between that and the GPU prices coming down, it's a good time to build a system. Just want to remind everybody of that. It's just, it keeps getting better. Something else was interesting. Ken wrote this one up too. Intel's CPU attached NVMe RAID uncovered on Asus Z370 motherboards. It was interesting and complicated, but VROC is essentially Intel Rapid Storage Technology for CPU attached Intel PCIe storage, which is not exactly VROC that you find in other Intel platforms. But I'm going to read the clarification from Intel from the article. The feature is actually part of RST. While this is a CPU-attached storage feature, it is not VROC. VROC is a CPU-attached PCIe storage component of the enterprise version of the product, Intel RSTe. VROC requires a new hardware feature, Intel Volume Management Device, Intel VMD, which is not available on the Z370 chipset. So the Intel Rapid Storage Technology for CPU-attached Intel PCIe storage feature is supported with select Intel chipsets and requires system manufacturer integration. Please contact the system manufacturer for a list of their supported platforms. So
that's clear now, right?
It's, you know, like sitting – like the Mississippi when all hell's broken loose. You can just see right to the surface of it. And then it gets confusing. I was helping a friend of mine build a system this week, and he's in this unusual situation where he has a tremendous number of security cameras, and he's using a piece of software that manages their motion detection. And it just, I don't know if it's poorly written or incredibly complicated, but the end result is that he needs all the cores he can throw at it, but he's an Intel guy. And, you know, I was telling him, I'm like, you're not going to get a huge bump between, you know, the previous chip and going with the, you know, with the 8087K, but you will have to use a Z370 chipset. And part of me looks at the Z370 and I keep thinking, like, is this going to be one of those orphan chipsets where it's basically associated with one processor? For everybody who bought that, and then they're going to have to buy a brand new motherboard when they turn around. I'm saying that because I had to explain to this person. I was like, you know, you could have gotten a lot more cores for less money by going with AMD, which is kind of my theme in life right now. I don't know. It's in any case, you know, I like the idea of raiding NVMe devices. You know, is this a level of performance that most people can't really do anything with?
I mean, that's probably fair to some degree. It's super high bandwidth throughput and a little bit better latency, but right. not dramatically so, I guess. In this case, if you remember VROC,
right?
This is kind of, it's hard to explain. It's kind of like VROC, but not really. And it was kind of a surprise feature showing as well, because this was not communicated by Intel or anything like that. We just happened to be, Ken was updating a board BIOS and noticed that, oh, in the release notes, it was like, hey, it supports RAID on CPU for this platform. We're like, well, that's kind of odd. We've never heard about this as a feature before. And we downloaded it and tested it and had some problems with it, came back to it and figured out how to do it with some hiccups along the way. You've got to have a specific card that does bifurcation. Right. And this card, you've got to use these two particular slots. It only works with Intel SSDs right now, even though we were pretty sure we had it working with Samsung SSDs at one point. So it's clearly not a feature that we would recommend somebody to roll out in their system that's like kind of a mission critical build. But it does, you know, you basically allows you to get past the four lanes of PCIe interface that is the DMI link between the processor and the chipset. Because right now you can do two M.2 RAID configurations on Intel Z370 platforms if the board has two M.2 slots on it, obviously, but those filter through the DMI bus. So it's a by four. If each of those SSDs is a by four, clearly you're bottlenecked and you're not going to get the full level of performance. The idea here is that you can exceed that, right? You can go up to by eight, right? So if you have a Z370 board, you have a discrete GPU, you can have it use eight lanes of PCIe. Then this these two M.2s on this riser card can now take up the other eight lanes. You get the full bandwidth and things like that. This seems, Ken mentioned this on our show last night, that it seems very much like it's kind of an in-development thing. Like maybe this is going to be on the Z390 chipset, and Asus kind of was like, I don't know, let's put it out on Z370 and see what we can figure out, what the troubleshooting is, get some people to beta test it for us or whatever, right? Or maybe it was never supposed to be released. I don't really know. But, you know, Intel's kind of reaction of, oh, that's not what this is not VROC. It's this totally different thing. Makes it seem like they were a little bit surprised that we were asking them about it at the same time, too. So,
oh, you found that.
Yes, exactly. Yes, very much like that. So I would look at it as, don't run this now. Don't do this thing. And instead, think of it as a preview of what may be coming later in the year when they release new S-series processors and maybe apparently another damn chipset. We'll see.
Just what we need, another damn chipset. Yeah, I mean, it's death RAID, it's RAID 0. It's at least, it's interesting. I don't see a lot of practical. I mean, for you guys doing 4K captures on GPU testing where you're moving staggering amounts of data across the bus, I can see where this would be useful. But for most people, it would be kind of tough. So this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. Ring's mission, it's simple. They want to make neighborhoods safer. They want to make your neighborhood safer. And the Ring Video Doorbell lets you see and speak to intruders on your smartphone from anywhere, even share video clips with neighbors using the Ring app. If you haven't seen Ring's Twitter feed, you need to head over to see some clips of the Ring Video Doorbell in action. I mean, let's see. Oh, that's a bear, people. Now, most of us are never going to have to worry about bears breaking into our minivans, but it's nice to know that it wasn't your teenage son coming home drunk at 2 a.m, and it was actually a large furry creature capable of separating your skull from your neck if you upset it badly enough. I mean, it seems silly, but it's nice to know, because I had a neighbor go berserk because he thought somebody had done something terrible to his landscaping in the front of his house, didn't realize that it was his own dog that it had done it. I just have to be on the porch watching at that point. With a Ring camera, you don't have to worry about whether or not I'm home watching your lawn when something terrible happens. And if you get Ring's floodlight and spotlight cam, you can build a ring of security around your entire property. It's just like Ring's video doorbell. The floodlight cam, motion-activated camera and floodlight that connects to your phone. You may like the idea that things get lit up at night. I certainly do when something goes bump in the backyard. High visibility floodlights, HD video, two-way audio, which is much nicer than going outside to yell at the thing in the backyard. Let you know the moment anybody steps in your property or any bear steps onto your property. See and speak to visitors, even set off an alarm right from your phone. When things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what it is because you've got a ring of security around your entire home. Ring floodlight cams offer the ultimate in home security. Thieves just can't hide with Ring. Monitor every corner of your property with a Ring of Security kit. That's a Ring video doorbell and your choice of either 1, 2, or 3 floodlight cams. Connect your Ring video doorbell with your favorite smart locks and hubs for added convenience, monitoring, and security. They want all the things to work together and work together well and help you feel safer. Stop crying before it happens and help make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Save up to $150 on the Ring of Security kit at ring.com/twitch. That's ring.com/TWICH. Up to $150 off when you go to ring.com/twitch. We want to thank Ring for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Any updates? Because you're running Ring at home and Ring in the office. Any weird things that you've spotted lately?
No, you know, the last time I had something odd would have been when some teenagers of age I don't know pulled into the office driveway and were drinking beer and throwing cans out there. So if I wanted to pursue that, I had their car and stuff on there. But mostly it's still just very functional. It's a doorbell. I know when I'm getting a delivery before they walk up to the door even, which is a super big advantage. If you have dogs and maybe your kid is asleep, you can put the dogs outside real quick before, you know, FedEx opens the door, or just meet them at the door before they do that. So big supporters here.
Yay. We like the security. Big story, 2016, Apple refusing to help the FBI to unlock an iPhone. They took a stance for privacy. FBI paid a third party to get into the phone. Interesting write-up in the New York Times this morning that Apple is, quote, closing the technological loophole that let authorities hack into iPhones, angering police and other officials, and reigniting a debate over whether the government has a right to get into the personal devices that are at the center of modern life. That's an argument that we are not even going to remotely get into at this point. It is interesting that they essentially are going to disable the charging and data port, the lightning jack on the iPhone. Much like the one right here on the bottom of my phone, kids, an hour after the phone is locked, and you'll still be able to charge the phone, but you'll have to enter the phone's password to transfer data on or off the device using the lightning port. So that is actually how law enforcement and various hackers have been tapping into locked iPhones. Essentially, there's a device they plug in and it does things. And people are pissed in law enforcement. So interesting thought. If you were not aware of it, that is how it's been getting done. That loophole will be closed, and expect anger and beating of chests to ensue all over the place.
Always do.
Oh, my goodness. A few more things coming out of Computex 2018. G-Skill attained 13 overclocking world records, including DDR4, 5,543 megahertz. Tim Verity did the write-up for this over at PC Per. If you haven't seen it, essentially G-Skill has extreme overclocking competitions. 13 world records, including the two highest DDR4 clock speeds and the fastest Core i7-8700K clock speed. This is pretty awesome, right? The Intel processors, G-Skill DDR4 memory, motherboards from MSI, EVGA, ASRock, and delidding processors, liquid nitrogen. And they were setting world records in 3D Mark Firestrike, SuperPi, MaxMem, Geekbench 4, GPU Pi for CPU, WPrime, PiFast. I'm still kind of, you know, given the trouble I've seen memory running at, like, you know, a biscuit under 3 gigahertz, the idea of hitting 5,543 megahertz is kind of awesome to me. And a Core i7-8700K running at 7,409.03 megahertz, also awesome. But I wonder how much liquid nitrogen they were dumping down onto that. So
probably not an cool. Insignificant amount would be my guess.
Yeah. I'm also fascinated by the RoboClocker LN2 cooler, which is, you know, it's kind of crazy. They have two massive nitrogen tanks situated to the left and right of that. And
right.
That's just a lot of liquid nitrogen to show up with.
I've heard some interesting discussions about when companies have these events at, say, a standard, like, downtown San Jose hotel ballroom, and the permits that you have to get in order to move containers of liquid nitrogen of that size are, you know, not simple. It's not a head into the local office and say, yeah, I want to bring, you know, 100 gallons of liquid nitrogen right into this building. I'm like, oh, yeah, no, here you go. It's they ask a lot of questions, as it turns out.
And which is probably really smart. I mean,
yeah,
I have a small Dewar I picked up. There's a local place that they usually do a lot of office furniture recycling, but they also will occasionally buy out, like, you know, one of the chemistry labs that's being upgraded at Cal, at yeah. University of Cal Berkeley. And there was a nitrogen douar there, and I've always wanted one because you can get liquid nitrogen locally that's, you know, that's good enough to do food, but they only have like three douars. And if you don't get it in, you know, if you don't reserve it, you can't get it. Sometimes even if you do reserve it, you can't get it. So I have like my own douar to carry around. I can carry around several gallons of liquid nitrogen. I can make ice cream. You know, I can freeze parts to assemble things with some of the weirder mechanical assemblies I've done. But liquid nitrogen in an enclosed space can be really scary. And one of the reasons I know that is because the crew that does the termite controller, did the termite control in our house when we first moved into it, that company had been experimenting with green termite eradication methods. And one of the big ones that they do is liquid nitrogen. And they were really enthusiastic on that. Nitrogen, it's a huge part of the atmosphere. It's that, it's the other thing. It's super awesome. But if somebody pours too much liquid nitrogen, you can end up having it displace enough of the oxygen in the air that you pass out and die, which is actually what happened to one of the guys on the crew. So I can see if somebody's, you know, if somebody's trying to bring in a couple hundred gallons of liquid nitrogen into a ballroom full of people, why they might be a little it's always awkward going for an overclocking record, several dozen people pass out. I can see where they might be a little uptight on that.
Fair.
Somewhat less uptight. Power Color was showing off a short RX Vega 56 at Computex 2018. They made it official. The Power Color RX Vega 56 Nano Edition. So 170 millimeters long, which for those of us who love the mini ITX cases is fantastic news. Whether or not you'll be able to actually buy one anytime soon is an entirely different question. And this was their original R9 Nano was something in the neighborhood of $650. So I think I'm looking at a short 1070 for my next build. But it's nice to know there's going to be AMD options out there. So.
If you remember back to the unveiling of Vega 64, Vega 56 at SIGGRAPH, AMD had a live event. I think they streamed it. They definitely streamed it, I think. I remember being corralled through metal detectors to go into this room. Mm-hmm. And they actually showed the Vega Nano at that event. I think they gave the first one, you know, ceremoniously to Tim Sweeney from Epic Games. And they gave him that card. And ever since then, we saw the launch of the Vega 64. We saw the launch of Vega 56. And, you know, then we had the mining crisis, the great mining crisis of 2017, 2018, as I call it now. And then this card never really materialized. It had like a standard AMD-based cooler on it, you know, AMD-branded fan and all that. And that never really came to be. And what was happening was, is if you looked at some of these Power Color cards that were shipping, they actually already had the short PCBs, but they were using larger, more significant coolers and fan setups, heat sinks and fans. And I don't know, at AMD's request or Power Color said they'd gotten enough, you know, people asking about it, that they decided to release the version that has the shorter cooler on it as well. And the original RX, R9 Nano, which came out with the Fiji products, you know, it wasn't like it was a huge seller, but it was a very unique product that NVIDIA never really countered with. They kind of progressively got smaller versions of, you know, 1070s and 1070s, right. 1080. Maybe they had a 1080 from Zotac or somebody. But this was one of the promised benefits of HBM memory and this new kind of GPU memory design, that you could have smaller PCBs. It turns out that having smaller PCBs doesn't negate the need to cool it. So you still have to have a beefy cooler on it. but they're at that place. So I'd be really curious to get one of these in and do some testing. How noisy is it? How consistent are the clock speeds of the GPU? That was one of the issues we had with the original R9 Nano as well. So maybe.
I'm just happy I didn't buy one of these 6 or 8 weeks ago, because, You know, you can now pick up a 1080 for $549, a 1060 with 6 gigabytes of RAM for $310. The 3 gigabyte 1060 is down as little as $230, $240. Yeah, really glad I didn't buy one of these for $500 and change a few weeks ago. That would have been painful. Noctua has lost their mind. I don't know how else to describe it. Possibly the weirdest thing at Computex. Black air coolers and fans. I'm just saying.
That's nuts.
It's crazy.
It's only crazy because it's Noctua, right? And if you're not familiar with the company, they are known for having brown and tan colored fans only forever. Mm-hmm. And while the world relished in RGB, they maintained tan fans.
And
now they're switching or they're adding.
They're adding, you know, the blacked out version of them. I like that Tim notes that notably lack any RGB LEDs. So we'll see. Late this year, early next year. So maybe we'll actually see them for sale at CES along with that next generation GPU from Intel. Yeah, I can see where market pressure would push them in this direction, but I've always kind of enjoyed the whole, like, we're Noctua, we do this thing, deal with it. If you want our cooling, yep, deal with our Band-Aid colored fans. something I'm curious to play around with. Sebastian wrote this one up. Rivet Networks announced their killer wireless extend technology, and their idea is that they're going to allow you to turn your gaming PC or your laptop, or in theory, this laptop I'm running on right now, which has killer wireless inside of it, into an extension or a wireless extender. And thanks to the network prioritization, it's kind of the foundation of Killer's technologies, that you will do it without having a penalty on performance. So essentially they're calling it mesh network capabilities, using the Killer Wireless AC1550 Wi-Fi module to, quote, seamlessly clone and extend the home network. So I'm kind of curious about that. And I want to check... Let me check, because I've got an XPS 13 inside of this, and according to my friend, the device manager, I've got a 1535. Drat. So close.
I think
15
it's
off.
15 points off, whatever that happens to mean. This is one of the things that Rivet and the Killer Network group, they've always had an uphill battle, right, of trying to sell added features or performance or capability for networking, because networking is one of those things that, especially once we hit gigabit networking and it was on every motherboard, it was kind of commoditized. I would say there's a big push now for 2.5G, 5G, 10 gigabit networks. All that stuff is, there's still a lot of room to grow for wired networking. But they always had a lot of interesting ideas and capabilities for what they could do, because they were uniquely positioned in that this is all they did. They only did networking in these things. And this is one of them, the wireless extend that says, hey, if you buy motherboards and they're going to have oftentimes two, maybe more Ethernet ports on them, and then they're going to have wireless on them as well. It's kind of, you know, if you're one of the people that hardwires your PC because you're a sane, reasonably accessible enthusiast, like all of us should be, we should all be hardwiring our PCs. Then what do you do with that wireless? Like, you paid for it. It's on the motherboard you bought. Maybe it's a $10 add-on or something like that to them. But, why not turn that into a wireless access point for, you know, your phones and your Xboxes and whatever else might be floating around in your room? I think it's a really good idea. Mm-hmm. I need to see it implemented. And I think there's a lot of potential. Well, we've seen issues in the past where wireless extenders, you know, sometimes, like, if your phone's on the edge, it won't actually move over to the node that's closer instead of sticking with the older one. And then, you know, mesh networks kind of got that right for the most part. But this isn't technically a mesh network. I'm a little bit fuzzy on the technicality of what the difference is there. But if they could get it working correctly, like they say they are, then I think it's neat, right? It's a neat addition.
I like the idea. I am not. One, I don't have enough in the way of latency issues, and two, I am not a talented enough gamer to really feel the difference on any of a number of the gaming-oriented routers or the killer NICs. I like the idea of them. I've measured some latency drops, but for the most part, because I am right now, I'm a mile if from one of the biggest colos on the West Coast, so.
Right.
I got a really short path to some really big pipes to the gaming servers. So there's some of the stuff I try to test where there's just not a huge difference. DNS actually, some of the DNS services don't work as well or don't provide as much advantage here as they would if I live 25 miles east or southeast of where I live. But
right.
I also got to say, I just want to amplify what Ryan said. If you're looking for the maximum in performance and the minimum in degraded service on your networking, just run an Ethernet cable to it. That's one of the things that always blows my mind. The emails I get, because I'm doing some more testing of some new mesh networking stuff. And, especially when you're looking at Netgear's Orbi, for example, which has this unbelievably fast wireless backhaul. And now you can actually do Ethernet backhaul too. And it's incredibly fast. And then you run Ethernet and it's incredibly faster in terms of the bandwidth it can carry and the speed you're moving at. So, Ethernet never goes out, doesn't get screwed up by a microwave, doesn't slow down because, somebody in your house decided to move the router from the top of the bookshelf to underneath the bookshelf behind. It doesn't get, I just want to say that, it's, Ethernet doesn't care about the plaster in your walls. It's,
true.
Just want to lay that out there. Although Ethernet, I have not run into a waterproof Ethernet access point yet, but I'll talk more about that next week to make a mild reference. Ladies and gentlemen, PCPer.com is the place to find Mr. Ryan Shrout. What's the best place? Is MarketWatch the best place to find your analysis on the business side of things? I mean, PCP perspective.
I wouldn't point you there because there's so much content there. Just follow me on Twitter at Ryan Shrout. I muse on there quite often.
You're on there about as often as I am, which is to say entirely too often for our family members.
That's very true.
I may be projecting. You can find me at techthing.com, TEKTHING.com. Or if you're looking for home theater and audio gear, check out AVXL.com. I host Tech Thing with Shannon Morris, AVXL with Robert Heron. And it's been exciting watching the 2018 TVs come out and looking at the performance on those and calibrating them, which has been a really interesting experience for Robert. You can find more of This Week in Computer Hardware. We like to call it Twitch over at twit.tv/TWICH. And we want to thank you so much for listening to this show. And if it's your first episode, please go to twit.tv/Twitch and get the links to automatically download us on your favorite podcatcher. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.